Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Bottom Up Revolution. I'm your host, Tiffany Owens Reed. I hope you all are doing well wherever you are. I know that summer is quickly approaching, and I hope that means that you get to look forward to a couple months of adventures. Today, I'm joined by Christian Gray. He is a native of Southern California, but now resides in Omaha, Nebraska with his family, where he is the executive director of In Common Community Development. He has worked in the field of national and international community development for 16 years, and I am excited to talk with him today. Christian, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tiffany. Thanks for having me.
To kick things off, can you tell us a little bit about Omaha? What do you love? What do you love about your city?
Yes, there's a lot to love. I've been in Omaha for about 20 years now. And like any great city, we have incredible people. We have incredible culture and things to do. But I think one of my favorite things is the size or the population size of Omaha. It's what I would call kind of like a civically friendly size. It's big enough that we can make an impact in the area, in the region, but small enough and sort of concise enough that we can figure out a way to engage and to make an impact in a way that's meaningful to each individual.
I like that phrase. I might steal it to describe kind of how I feel about living in Waco, because you moved to Omaha from California. I moved to Waco from New York. And people have asked me, it took a while to be able to answer this question. I'm not going to lie. I was kind of a grouch for a while about living in Waco. But they would ask me like, oh, what do you like about Waco? Surely there's something, Tiffany. And actually, one of the first answers that came to my mind was like, you know, it feels easy to be involved. Like that phrase of civically friendly. Like, I think that kind of summarizes one of the things I really do appreciate, where it is easy to get to know like who's on your council and they'll actually meet up with you for coffee. And if you want to be involved, like those opportunities are not hard to find. And people seemed very open to people, even New Yorkers, trying to be engaged, which was really encouraging because I actually was pretty nervous that everyone would tell me to go back where I came from, but they did not.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, very similar experience. Very, very civically friendly. You get to know people personally, down to, you know, even the mayor sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. So do you have like a memorable or favorite story that you feel summarizes the difference between living in California versus living in Nebraska?
Yeah, I do. And actually, as we're getting to that too, I was just thinking of Orange County as the precise area that I came from California. It has 34 incorporated cities, I believe. So talk about the difference between kind of civically and friendly size to, you know, a complex web of cities that you try to navigate your way through. But, you know, we followed a job out to Omaha about 20 years ago, and it went on for a couple of years, and we had the choice to go back to Orange County or to stay. And we really loved Omaha enough that we wanted to stay. And one of the early examples and memories I have of really, you know, connecting with the community is around the College World Series. Omaha hosts the College World Series every year. It's just like a really great event. So not only is it sort of nationally recognized, and it's just really engaging and really fun. And I love college sports, but the first neighborhood my family and I were living at was walking distance to the original home of the College World Series, which was called Rosenblatt Stadium. So I just remember walking from my house through the gates of Rosenblatt Stadium and thinking, this is amazing. I get to go to a really incredible event. And it's so accessible. I just walked to it. I didn't have to get on the 405 freeway. I got right to the front of the gates and wasn't stuck in traffic. So just, I think that really sort of captures the greatness about Omaha.
Yeah, that feeling of accessibility. In your line of work, I bet you've seen that the perceived like accessibility is really important when it shapes like people's feeling that they can be involved. I know this question is a little bit off script, but it's just coming to mind of like I remember living in Brooklyn. The idea of being involved felt so overwhelming and intimidating because I was like me be involved in local, like civics, like in New York City, like I'm nobody. Like what would that even look like? Like who would even listen to me versus Waco? It definitely is just a different dynamic. So I bet you've seen that shape kind of the conversation around engagement and just a political agency.
Yeah, absolutely. Political agency for sure. And, you know, we might talk about it a little bit here later, but one of the things that we do at In Common is around leadership development. And one of the topics of our leadership development course is the city organizational plan or structure. And at the top of that, everybody's just always so surprised sometimes to remember that citizens are at the top of the organizational chart for the city. It's us who leads the way. And yeah, that's an important reminder that who runs the city, we do as citizens, and there's a way for us to get involved.
That is very true and very important. I feel like just increasingly more important now, where it feels like the cities are increasingly professionalized, where it's like, oh, the experts do that. And we just kind of like hear about what they decided in the news. Recovering that sense of political agency is a huge part of the conversation when it comes to just thinking about the future of our communities and cities. You started to touch on this already, but I'd love for you to just give us an overview of In Common and what you all do there.
Yeah, so our mission at In Common is to stop poverty at the roots by strengthening neighborhoods. And our commitment in doing that is really through leveraging the strengths, gifts, and talents of local residents to make change. We can talk about that as well, but with that, it just means that most of what we do, if not all of what we do, is really to support, encourage, strengthen, equip our local neighbors to be able to have that self-determination and self-agency as you're describing it. And that usually comes in the bucket, about three buckets in particular: economic stability and workforce development. So making sure that our neighbors aren't worried about how they're going to put food on the table because it becomes really difficult to get involved in higher level things in the city and your neighborhood if you're worried about those basic needs. Second is leadership training. So building that civic muscle, making sure that our neighbors have all that they need to know how to navigate through the neighborhood and make change. And then third, it's through community organizing and developing collective efficacy. So that's really just about linking these individual, isolated at times leaders into a collective body that can actually group up and have power to make change. And kind of new for us too is affordable housing, just to sort of support all the things I just talked about to make sure that we don't have that leadership drain in our community. We've begun to get into affordable housing as well.
So just to orient the listener a little bit, can you tell us about the two neighborhoods that you work in?
Absolutely. Yep. We work in two neighborhoods in Omaha, Nebraska. They're both urban neighborhoods in the community. One's known as Park Avenue and the other is Walnut Hill. They're really amazing neighborhoods. There's so many strengths and gifts about them. Largely, to start with, we have great ethnic and socioeconomic diversity in the communities. They're also very historic neighborhoods that have long, great stories. We also have, for instance, in Park Avenue, it was the birthplace of Gerald Ford, President Ford, and the childhood home of Marlon Brando. So just really great stories. We have old architecture. These are, you know, turn-of-the-century neighborhoods. And we're just a couple miles from downtown. So in terms of accessibility again and getting from point A to point B, it's just a really conveniently located, both neighborhoods are very conveniently located. Also, I'll mention Park Avenue has the highest population density in our city as well. So the most people per square mile, which makes a very vibrant, engaged neighborhood.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about the model that I know you all use. Just as we're on the topic of how you all, like these three buckets, as you mentioned, but then like how you actually approach community development. You and I talked a little bit about this in our pre-chat, but can you talk about asset-based community development? Because I know that's central to how you all approach your work. Can you tell us what that is and what does that look like for you on the ground?
Yeah, great. That's our primary engine, and our methodology is asset-based community development. And, you know, for the listener who might not be familiar, asset as in ASSET or strength-based community development, popularized by Kretzmann and McKnight, really is this idea of leveraging existing strengths in communities to make them strong. Traditionally, and unfortunately, I think we've taken sort of a pothole approach to community development. We look at the challenges in the community and we figure out how do we fill up these potholes, these deficits, these insufficiencies. Really asset-based community development is starting what's already there, what's strong. There's a writer, a thinker on the topic called Cormac Russell. And he says, start with what's strong, not with what's wrong. So that's really what asset-based community development is. And the primary strength of any neighborhood are the people. So that kind of goes back to our work in terms of supporting and encouraging and equipping local residents, because the greatest strength of the people who already live there and finding out what their gifts are, their talents are, and putting those to work for the good of the community.
I love that overview because I feel like that's transferable to anybody like listening to this podcast who might be interested in thinking of ways to contribute to their community. And this idea of starting with what's strong and not what's wrong, I feel like is something that might stay on my mind for a while because I wonder how that would shape conversations and shape ideas and actions in our community. If we kind of, I feel like sometimes it's so easy, especially if you're a Strong Towns fan, to kind of look at your city and be like, oh my goodness, we have too many Strohs. Oh my goodness, we have too many, you know, whatever, highways, or we don't have enough affordable housing. Like all of those problems might be legitimate, but I like the challenge in this model of like, okay, you might know all of those things that are wrong with your city, but what are some strengths? What is working, and how can you, what would it look like if you started with that? I feel like there's kind of a challenge mm-hmm. in that.
Yeah, I agree.
So can you tell us a little bit, maybe if you have like a snapshot or a story of kind of like what it has looked like for you over these past two decades to like cultivate this asset-based community development approach in these two neighborhoods?
Yeah, you know, it's we use a lot of the standard tools for asset-based community development, which oftentimes starts with mapping the assets of the community. So we really pay attention to what are the pre-existing strengths. And for us, we do very geographically specific work in two neighborhoods. We're looking within those particular boundaries and really trying to collect and understand what's there. And then it's a lot of listening. So it's really about approaching folks in terms of really getting to know them and to understand them and to hear what their thoughts are for the community, as opposed to sort of a need survey. So relationship building, listening, really documenting, who you're meeting and where are the strengths located in the neighborhood. And that's produced really incredible things. One of our favorite stories is we got to know and work and develop relationships with some young people in the community, high schoolers, junior high schoolers, who really had a passion for soccer. And through leveraging their passion for soccer and their strengths, they flexed their civic muscle to build a soccer field in our local park. So when you really find out what people are passionate about and what they're good at, that's just a great way to leverage that towards something good for everybody.
I bet you've had, has it been interesting to you to when you talk to people, to kind of hear their responses when you ask them like what they think the strengths are in their community?
Yeah, it is. You know, in our Park Avenue neighborhood, we have a really old, great historic park. So sometimes it's sort of expected that people will mention the park, but sometimes, yeah, a strength will be really off the map. And those are the ones that we really want to pay attention to too, because in terms of community organizing, it's a great opportunity to figure out who else has that similar vision or lens for the neighborhood that we might be able to introduce them to and see if something good can come out of that.
But I bet it can kind of like make people stop and think, because I feel like maybe people are used to complaining a lot. So you're like, well, tell me the strength. Yeah. And it's like, wait, what?
Yeah, you're exactly right. You know, in our
I mean, myself included.
yeah, right. Exactly. Right on. Our listening project starts with what are you good at? You know, what's your name and what are you good at? And I think that does really, you know, sort of take a minute for people to sort of recalibrate, because they're wondering why you're asking about them and why you're taking this particular approach. And there's something really beautiful, but to your point, very upside down and different about that approach too.
I want to ask you as well, you used this phrase earlier called the civic muscle phrase. Can you tell our listeners, what does that mean and what does that look like? Kind of just cultivating conversations around that and helping the residents in these communities kind of envision themselves as political agents.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this would be a great point moment too to talk about or just mention that a lot of our staff, myself included, our neighbors ourselves. So when we're working with neighbors, we're really working with our neighbors too, which is always great. But yeah, civic muscle really is just this idea of helping each other to understand what changes we're able to make. And it kind of goes, again, it starts a little bit with that organizational chart for the city. What power do we have? Understanding what power we have in the city. And then really trying to link people together so we're not just isolated bodies, but we're really leveraging the social capital of our neighbors so that they are working together. And that's where the muscle comes from, I think. I think there's like sort of civic smarts and individual leadership, but the muscle really comes from when we bring people together in coalitions and bodies and groups, because now we have various strengths and various sort of perspectives, but we also have more people. And you know, when you have more people listen to the ideas of that group of people.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's like a big part of the whole concept of a bottom-up revolution is reclaiming a sense of political agency, kind of this bottom-up agency, though. It's and sort of bridging the and helping citizens realize like they can bridge the gap between like their lived experience in the community and the priorities of those who are in public office or who are on staff, and kind of realizing that gap is not going to be bridged automatically all the time. You know, you really need like citizen advocates and people who realize they have agency to step up and facilitate the kind of conversations that ensure that the priorities on the political side are actually corresponding to the priorities on the lived side. I like that phrase, civic muscle. So on your website, you all have a line kind of going back to what you mentioned about this organization having a emphasis on tackling poverty. You have this line, a child's zip code is a powerful predictor of his or her life outcome. It reminds me of what I read in a David Brooks article that I sent, well, I told you about, and then you graciously sent it to me, about the neighborhood as a unit of change. I'd love just to hear your thoughts on that and how kind of from your experience, how have you seen and how would you explain the power of investing in the neighborhood as a unit of change? And just to give the reader some context, David Brooks sort of, he contrasts the focusing investment in the neighborhood as compared to focusing investment in the individual. But I feel like people can look at that lots of different ways, focusing on the neighborhood versus focusing on the city or like the national, right? So I feel like some people could look at that differently. But anyway, I just love to hear your take on that and what you've learned just from your experience as it pertains to the value of investing at the neighborhood scale.
Yeah, great. Well, you know, and David Brooks mentioned Raj Chetty, I think, in his article too. And there's some great thinkers like him and Robert Sampson and others who've really leveraged and leaned into this idea in term of neighborhood effect. That saying that there is an effect of the neighborhood, and I think it calls back to sort of verifying and validating that old ideology that we're products of our environment. So it says that where we grew up matters because of all the environmental conditions around us. This is where our schools are, our institutions are, our relationships are, the quality of our housing is affected by that, the access to food. There's so much that goes into our environment that makes us into the people that we become. And so if we can change neighborhoods, if we can change that environment, then we've changed not only one individual, but we've changed a whole pool of individuals who've grown up in that particular environment. And not only that, we've changed not only a generation, created a new sort of pathway for a generation of people coming up, but if we do a good job and it's sustainable and we're leveraging local leadership, it's a generational impact. That change will remain in place. The changes that you've made in the neighborhood are still there generation after generation. So it's really getting at the systems of where we come from, what human development means and how we flourish as people.
Yeah, I think what stood out to me about the David Brooks piece is he kind of positions the neighborhood not just as a physical place, like a physical environment, but as a collection of relationships and like networks. Like he talks about those different case studies, the different like the heat wave in Chicago, for instance. Why did some people in one neighborhood do pretty well and didn't have that many like health emergencies or fatalities, but then another neighborhood not that far away, you know, tragically suffered kind of the opposite outcome. And one of the things he pointed out was like, well, the social capital centered on the library, I think, in one of the neighborhoods was totally lacking in the other one. And so kind of really honing in on like investing in the neighborhood really is kind of a proxy for investing in social capital, investing in those connections that help people feel more connected to each other, access more resources and stuff like that.
I think that's right on. And I do think that's part of that environmental thing. So we do have the physical environment that we grow up in. But we also have the social environment, and the social environment is really critical. And that's one thing I think we can all do to really make our neighborhoods great places to live is to really invest in those social connections. those social connections make us healthier. They make us, they open up opportunities that we might not otherwise have, that kind of bridging social capital. So in my opinion, I think that's the most important thing that we can all do in our neighborhoods and the places that we're working is bridge those social ties together so that they're working together.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you tell me a little bit about the emphasis on children, like for you and just from your experience and what you've seen, like why is this so critical for children?
Yeah, children, I mean, beyond just the fact that children are amazing, right? And we all love are. Children. We want to see them thrive. This is a very important time of development when we're kids, right? Kids are drinking it all in. And that's why the environment's so important, because we want to put them in a position where they're drinking in all the good stuff. And not only for their existing lives, right? Like we want kids to flourish in the here and now. But the reason that neighborhoods are so important and this neighborhood effect is because, as some of these writers and thinkers I mentioned earlier, they talk about the durability or the stickiness of your zip code. So it doesn't just affect you as you're a kid, but it carries forward with you into life, and it's who you are as an adult. And so, yeah, it's just a prime place where we can invest in kids so that they can become, you know, amazing people as they grow up.
But also, just circling back to what you were saying earlier about, you know, thinking of children as like your community's number one asset in a way, like not in this like hyper transactional sense, but truly seeing them as like, as an asset, you know, and thinking of future generation, you know, investing now and then future generations. But I think when you're able to cultivate that sort of long-term buy-in to a community, that's something not to take lightly.
No, you're right. You're right. That's exactly it. And, you know, we don't call the young people in our neighborhood future leaders. We call them leaders. You know, they're current leaders. One thing that we often quote and you know, reflect on is that old proverb that says, the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. The second best time is today. So it's, you know, what amazing things can we do? And now we've been in the game for, you know, going on 20 years, and we're starting to see the fruit of that long-term investment and that generational investment. But the things that we want in 20 years, we need to start planting, you know, sort of 20 years ago and see them come out later.
You mentioned this earlier, but how you yourself, your family, and a lot of your staff live in the neighborhoods that you're working in. And this is something I've been thinking about lately, just the importance of proximity when it comes to strengthening our neighborhoods, and just the value of living like where we serve, whether that's as a church or even as a nonprofit. What have you learned in your two decades of serving and living in these communities about the importance of proximity?
Yeah, I love that question, Tiffany. I love the idea in reflecting on proximity, because I joke a lot with friends that I hardly leave the neighborhood, right? When you live in the neighborhood that you work in and you sort of, I guess, shop in and all those other things, your commute's very, very small, and your sort of, circle is small in that regard. But proximity is so important, because I think that's how things get done. There's a sense of not being an outsider, but an insider, right? What additional strength is there? There is so much additional strength in being an insider, and really being able to go shoulder to shoulder with people in that work. I think also it gives you different eyes to see. We've all had that phenomenon where we've driven by something a million times, and it isn't until we walk, you know, that slow pace of just pedestrian life that we notice something that we wouldn't otherwise know. So it allows us to get closer to things. So that, and the credibility and authenticity of our work, I think is all wrapped up into proximity.
Yeah, I feel like trust as well. You know, like I've thought a lot about this, mostly in the context of church, because here in Waco, we go to a church. We don't live far from it. It's actually it's pretty close. But just thinking about like the dynamic of people commuting to church, and thinking about, I feel like when you live in proximity, the frequency of your touch points just like increases exponentially, right? Like imagine living three doors down from someone from your church versus living 10 minutes away, right? I've had this actual experience where I used to live like a 4-minute walk from a family from church that I never get to see really during the week in an organic, spontaneous fashion anymore, because now I'm a 10-minute drive, right? And just all the coordination, the logistics and the planning that go into like actually being able to be at their house versus before I was like, oh, I'm bored. I'll just walk to Mary's house and see what they're up to, right? Help out with the kids for a minute. And so I think that like proximity, like you can't have like that spontaneity or that. And I think that just plays into trust, right? Because you can, I feel like it's a lot easier to open up about life and talk about things and like share life when you're able to have so many more touch points like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Those touch points are huge. And the number of them, like you said, the frequency of those, and the depth of those, because they're in person, they mean so much. I think with that too, it reminds me of, I really appreciate the work that the Christian Community Development Association has done over the years, the acronym CCDA. It's been led by this amazing organizer named John Perkins. He's talked about the 3 R's of community development. Maybe you guys have talked about it on the show. But relocation, reconciliation, redistribution. But relocation or location, if you're already in the community, really allows these other two things in terms of reconciliation. It allows us to be able to have new relationships and bridge relationships that might have otherwise been broken because of just the way society is constructed. And then I also love that idea of redistribution, because now the proximity allows us, when we move it from charity to investment in our own community, we now are investing not in some sort of like school that needs additional support, but it's our school where our kids go. It's not some park that, you know, is in need, but it's our park where our kids play. And so there's something that's important in that self-serving. And I know that's often not a very generous way to look at life, but you know, things that affect us, we get motivated for, and we stay around for the long game. And I think there's something important with that proximity, because we're now owners of the future of this place, as opposed to philanthropists in it.
Yeah. Yeah. I really appreciate that perspective. And just that extension of this concept. What have been some of the challenges that you've seen over these past couple of years? And maybe you could share just from those experiences, any wisdom you have on investing in neighborhoods and caring about communities in general.
Yeah, you know, the biggest challenge I think we've been facing, and you know, historically in our neighborhoods, has been high poverty rates. But more recently, it's been encroaching gentrification. And you know, at least from my perspective, sometimes that's a nasty, bad word, but I think it's initially a neutral word. It's about sort of a new resources coming into a neighborhood, and the effect of those is sort of what might maybe good or bad. But as we've seen redevelopment and gentrification happen, our neighborhoods really are our primary concern and motivation, and you know, the work that I mentioned earlier in terms of the different focuses and programs we have are to really ensure that our neighbors who've been there for the long haul are in place to benefit from the changes that are happening, right? So if there are new grocery stores, if there's new housing, if there's new amenities, they should be the first in line to really reap the benefits of that change. And that's really informed our work over the last decade or so, as we've seen some of the opportunities and, of course, the challenges that come with redevelopment and gentrification.
Mm-hmm. That's such a complex issue. I feel like we could have a whole another episode just wrestling with what that actually looks like on the street level, you know?
I think that's really the national question, right? Because we've seen these cities, you know, emptied and disinvested. And, you know, obviously it's not just happening in Omaha, where they're sort of returned to the city. And, you know, the thing that I hear often in my work is, wow, isn't this place so much better? And the question, yeah, I threw up air quotes for those who you can see, but you know, the question is better for who? And there's, it's such a issue of justice and rightness that folks who, have been in this these communities really, really reap the benefits of it. It's happening everywhere. It's really about how do we direct that and get thoughtful and intentional about ensuring that it doesn't come at the expense of folks who, have been in the neighborhood for maybe decades.
Yeah. But more than anything, like positions them to practice their agency in the way that they want to, right? And I think that's just adds the layer of complexity to it, because you sent me this really great overview of asset-based community development. And one of the themes that seemed really clear to me was kind of using that as a framework to position people to realize that they were the main engines of improvement and change in their own community. And so kind of just coming back to this theme of agency. And so, yeah, thinking about how do we preserve a sense of agency, like participation too, as well, you know, like as like there is a sense of inevitability around the return to the city, right? Just because of the objective realities of like people like to be able to walk places. Like cities are starting to rediscover that some of the most valuable land is in the core, right? And we want cities to steward that asset well and get and like make that productive, put that land to productive uses, right? It is really complicated. It's like, well, how do we both advocate for good use of limited resources? Like, yeah, we should be using our land as productively as we can and like stewarding that resource. But at the same time, how do we look at it through this more social and community perspective and realize, well, there are people who have been living there when nobody thought it was important to steward that neighborhood, right? But how do we do, how do we navigate that in a way that, and I think participation really is a big part of it. It's like, well, how do we bring those people to the conversation, right? So that the outcome is something that's truly based on like collaboration and conversation rather than it just being what I feel like happens a lot where all of a sudden there's a fancy hotel going up in your neighborhood and like no one even knows what's going on, right?
Right. I think you hit it there too, right? It's participation requires an element. You know, there's a lot of elements involved, but one of it is a knowledge base of what's happening. And I think there's so much responsibility and work that we need to do as communities to make sure that people are well informed of what's happening and beyond the sort of the basic, you know, regulations of what we need to mail out within a certain, you know, geography. If we're doing a project, people really need to be informed. And if they're informed, then they do have a little more agency than they wouldn't have otherwise, because they can get involved and they can at least see it coming rather than it happening to them. They're sort of in a place that they can hopefully guide it forward.
Yeah. And I think on the other side of this, on the development side, I would hope that I think part of it has to be sort of a willingness to sort of put boundaries around the pursuit of efficiency and maximum gain, right? It's like, well, what's the goal here? Is the goal just extract as much as we can from the land or from this neighborhood? Or I think maybe tempering that with also like the objective of honoring the community that's already there, not to the point where it's like you take on all kinds of weird distortions that are like unsustainable, but just kind of, I think we kind of need a new conversation for like, well, what counts as a thriving neighborhood? Is it just, you know, I think there's people who can go too far on the preserving things side. And it's like, that's not really, in my opinion, like a meaningful goal, just to preserve things the way they are from this kind of like overemphasis on trying to preserve the community that's there. It's like, well, we don't want to deprive the community of actually objective improvements, right? But then on the other end, it's like, we don't need to chase like improvement to the point, you know, where there's no recognition for the community that is there and the neighborhood that is there. So yeah, I feel like kind of having a more robust conversation about like, what's actually our end goal? Is it just to maximize value? I don't know. I'm not a developer. Yeah. I'm probably using all the wrong words, but hopefully I'm getting some kind of idea.
And Tiffany, that brings up sort of one of the things that we've done in hopes of what you're describing, I think, is we do neighborhood-based plans. So before,
oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. Yeah, tell us more about that.
Yeah, but you know, before we just start doing a host of just different random works in the neighborhood, I think there's so much that we need to think about and so much opportunity in having a strategy for it. So, what is the end goal, right? And I think one of the ways that we can think about that is maybe what you're hinting at in terms of, is it just as much sort of, you know, luxury housing and wealth as possible? Or is there a balance? Is there some sort of balance we're going for? Is there even a way to articulate this in terms of percentages? We want, you know, X number of housing in our community to be beyond, you know, at or below this area medium income. But in addition to, you know, sort of the economics of it, what kind of like public spaces do we want? Green spaces do we want? Other amenities. It really brings in that holistic sense of what are we after together as a community. And then that's kind of the document we use for our community organizing and collective efficacy work is now that we have this document, this vision for the neighborhood, let's figure out what we want to accomplish this year. Let's go through this and see if there's something that we can go after and achieve together toward that whole goal, that broader goal, as opposed to a one-off effort.
This reminds me of the conversation, the one I had before that, where I talked to a grassroots community organizer in Lehigh Valley. I'm pretty sure that's in Pennsylvania. What he said and what you said are kind of the same thing of like being proactive, like help a community, like taking the position of, instead of waiting for a developer to come here and then we all have to react to the inevitable gentrification, how about we take a more proactive position, actually shape what we want for the community, so that when that developer does come, we're in a really great position to say like, hey, we recognize you're bringing something of value. Here's our plan. Here's our vision. How can you step into this? Yeah. Like, how can we talk about this vision and, you know, and find ways to achieve both of our objectives? But I think so often, you know, communities or cities kind of, communities that are at those border communities, right? They're really close to downtown. They tend to be historic. They're like usually kind of the prime locations where you tend to see more of this gentrification happening. It's like, well, what if we change the conversation from like, let's just resist all change to like, hey, let's be proactive about articulating the change that we actually want to see and take into account these like market realities. But let's figure out a way that we can take those into account and also preserve the sense of place and sense of community that we already have here. So I think that message of like, be proactive, shape the vision you want. And I think actually like developers, I'm sure there are plenty of developers that would respond really well to that, because in a way you're reducing the uncertainty for them and making their lives a lot easier by being upfront.
Right. About yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, to that effect, like how exciting would that be to be a developer where the community outreach is kind of done? You know, you already
right,
have people
exactly.
engaged in the conversation, engaged in the process. And we've even looked at our neighborhood plans as instead of developers coming to us, can we use this as a way to shop for projects, to shop for developers, to seek out partners who want to accomplish the things that we've already articulated and envisioned coming into the neighborhood. So yeah, you're spot on. I think there's power, right? We talked about there's power in knowing, and there's also power in planning to really have a strategy of what you want to accomplish.
Well, it's all about flexing that civic muscle, right?
That's it. Flex
there
it.
We go. All right. Well, last question, Christian. This is the one I ask everybody on the show, which I love to hear everyone's response. If someone was coming to your town, perhaps your neighborhood, for a few hours or for a day, what local spots should they check out for a slice of local life?
Yes, of course. Well, of course, you have to come to the Park Ave Commons and the Walnut Hill Commons and visit us in common. We'd love to have you. But, you know, as I was thinking through this, and I was like, you know what, there's a family that used to live across the street from our house, and they unfortunately got displaced through some of the redevelopment. And they used to have these taco nights on Friday nights, and they were the best kind. I can't remember, but it was something that was kind of a particular grill that made a particular type of meat. And they've recently launched a new business called Tacos Iglesia del Pueblo. So honestly, their food is unbelievable. So I'd recommend them top and foremost, because they were neighbors, and they've really rebounded and made some, you know, an incredible opportunity. I mentioned earlier the College World Series that happens every June. So that's a must do bucket list. And then, you know, I'd say our city has been really doing a lot of reinvestment in our downtown areas, as a lot of places are. Our newest thing is called the Riverfront Park. It connects the Missouri River to what we call the Old Market, which is this historical favorite in downtown Omaha, with a lot of shopping and entertainment. So just a lot of great walkability downtown. If you just pull up anywhere, you're going to find a good place to just have a nice stroll.
Awesome. I have to know, though, do you have a favorite coffee shop? I've just decided this is a thing in my life where, like, I just love coffee shops. Do you have a favorite one where you are?
Yeah. Well, you know what? We actually are very blessed in Omaha. We have a world-renowned coffee shop, Winner and Archetype Coffee. Hello, Isaiah, if you're out there. Omaha, just for being a pretty small town, we have some of the best coffee actually in the whole entire world. So you definitely have to check out Archetype when you're
Archetype. Okay.
In Omaha.
Are you all in any type of competition with Kansas City when it comes to coffee?
You know what? I am not that aware of the coffee challenges.
Or I'm not either. I just happen to know.
Yeah. What do we wrestle Kansas City for? I'm not sure. I think we've been pretty friendly. But one day when we grow up, we want to be Minneapolis, if that's fair.
Okay. Well, I just know there's like a serious roasting scene in Kansas City. So I wasn't sure if there's some competition. When you said best in the world, I was like, I don't know, man. I feel like those are some big words.
I don't know. Our Archetype Coffee just won the national competition for coffee. And number one.
Wow.
Number one. Yeah.
That is extraordinary. I've lived in some pretty cool coffee towns. So I'm quite impressed.
Number three, I think, in the world. So definitely something to check out.
That you've sold me. Well, Christian, thanks so much for coming on the show. Thanks for just sharing your story and graciously handling all of my off-script conversational questions. I really appreciate it. And just sharing more about what you've been doing and more about just so much. I feel like you've given us all so much to think about when it comes to advocating for our communities. If you're listening to the show, thank you so much for listening to another episode. I'd love to hear feedback, by the way. I never say this at the end, but if you ever have feedback or questions or ideas, you can always email me, tiffany@strongtowns.org. If there's someone you think we should interview on this show, we have a form that you can fill out in the show notes. I believe it's our suggest a guest form. So please nominate someone that you feel like is modeling the bottom-up method when it comes to improving their community. Thanks so much. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode.